The writers and illustrators of the future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we welcome back author, screenwriter, and animator Buzz Dixon. He's a really fun guy and we had a really great talk. Here's Buzz. Hi, Buzz. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sherry. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
How's everything in your part? You're in L.A., right?
I'm as far north as you can be and still legally be in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm up near Magic Mountain, for anybody who's familiar with the area.
Oh, I'm very familiar.
Yeah.
I was raised in L.A., so we have the same weather.
Yeah.
It's been gloomy, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it usually in June gloom, the clouds burn off by noon, but they haven't been doing that.
Not recently. We've had a couple of bright days, bright afternoons recently, but we've had cloudy mornings.
Yeah, but it's just strange weather.
Mm-hmm. It's going to get stranger, what can I say?
Yeah, I know. It's just like that series of storms that we had earlier, out of nowhere. I mean, it was sort of like El Nino, but it wasn't. That I'm used to.
Yeah.
Other than the weather, how have you been doing? I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Well, family has been doing well. My wife and I are local community gardeners, so we go out several times a week and work in a garden patch, and then I'm at home writing, and I'm working on new projects all the time, and it's very placid, what can I say? If anybody's looking for drama in my life, I have none to provide.
No. Peace is good. Peace is always good.
Yeah.
Have you been doing any reading?
Yes. I have just started on a novel by Peter Watt. And let me get the title for you right now. It is a really great first contact novel. I'm about a third of the way through it, but I'm really enjoying it. Blindsight by Peter Watts. And it is, so far, one of the best first contact novels I've read.
Wow.
He does a really good job of imagining a couple of hundred years in the future what human society is like, and then humanity encounters what may or may not be intelligent life. If you're familiar with the thought experiment, The Chinese Room, this is what the novel is based on. The Chinese Room is a thought experiment where you have a person who is in a room and you slide pieces of paper under the door written in Chinese. And he has no idea what they mean, but he has a lectionary of Chinese symbols that tells him, if you get this symbol, respond this way. If you get this symbol, respond this way. And he will send back signals from the dictionary because it says, if you get this, send this back. So after a while, he gets to the point where he just instantly recognizes what the symbols are that are coming in, and he knows from experience, respond with this symbol, respond with that symbol. Question is, does he understand Chinese?
Yeah.
And this is what the novel is about. Humanity encounters something that, and this was written like 10 years ago, before AI became like really, the hot topic item. Humanity encounters something that apparently can parrot back a very human sounding response, but there's no way of determining if the thing sending it back is actually intelligent or not. And so, like I said, I'm about a third of the way into it. It is really well written. I'm enjoying it immensely, and I would recommend it to anybody who's a science fiction fan, particularly those who are fans of First Contact stories.
It sounds good.
It is.
I'm rereading The Time Machine.
Ah.
I love that book.
Yeah. No, that's give Wells credit. I mean, he created several very specific subgenres of science fiction. So, very memorable book.
It just, if he wasn't so darn Edwardian, there's some problematic things that they put in it.
Well, he had,
you gotta put it in his time period, you know.
Yeah. he was part of what was called the Fabian group. And the Fabians were socialists, but they were authoritarian socialists. And they believed that there should be a well-educated elite that runs the world by socialist principles. And this reflects in some of his writings, particularly if you've seen the movie Things to Come. You know, Things to Come, you watch it, and you get kind of uncomfortable towards the end of it, because even though they've stopped the war and they've rebuilt civilization, it does not look like a very democratic society at that point.
Yeah.
But, Wells, you can't fault Wells for having ambitions to better the human race. You can question what he thought would be the most effective strategies to do so.
Yeah, it was also, I forgot what they call it, where you you take a part of people that are, you know, you breed them out, the parts of people.
Yeah,
that,
eugenics. Yeah.
I couldn't think of the word.
Yeah.
He also believed in that because that was in Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. That was a belief that was unfortunately all too common in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And then, of course, tragically, we saw, you know, when you put that stuff into actual application, you see what it looks like during the Holocaust. And so now we have backed away from that. Now we are recognizing, there is no single perfect human genotype that this is the ideal Superman and we want everybody to be like that. We have to have a wide variety of people, of abilities, of mindsets, of everything, in order to function. We can't find that perfect human being, so we need to accept everybody.
I remember there was some episodes of the original Star Trek. The most famous space seed was Ricardo Montalban as Khan.
Yeah.
About the superhuman, the perfect human, all this stuff. But he was really, he was handsome, he was well-spoken, but he was a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there were, the nice thing about Star Trek, the original series, is it's what I call the Doctor Who principle. And to me, the best Doctor Whos were the ones that were shot on shoestring budgets, where they basically said, look, if you will agree to pretend this papier-mâché rock is an alien planet, we will tell you an entertaining story. But you have to meet us halfway. You have to pretend that this is an alien world. You have to pretend this is really a robot. You have to pretend this is really a monster. You do that, and you'll get a good story. And the virtue of that is that you aren't required to be realistic. The stories can be a little more allegorical. They can be a little more, I won't say abstract, but a little more of the intellectual as opposed to the concrete. Now with special effects giving you these ultra-realistic scenes, you watch them do stories, and it undermines the story because, well, this is kind of stupid when you think about it. And if you're watching a show with a papier-mâché rock and a painted backdrop that's an alien world, well, no, you're pretending along at that point. But if you're watching something that's got, like, you know, HD special effects and every little nut and bolt visible, then it starts to undermine the story.
I think the most touching episode was when Star Trek was the Horta episode about the silicon rocks that were alive.
Yeah.
That was
right.
Such a touching episode. It was it was like it was really as far from being a human as you could possibly be, but still you felt for the mother and that her children were killed by accident, but still her children were killed. And you had emotion for that rock.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it worked because it didn't look absolutely 100% realistic. You accepted, oh, that's a matte painting. Oh, these are actors I've seen a dozen times before in cop shows and westerns. That monster really looks like a rug, doesn't it? But you're willing to pretend along. You're willing to go along with. I posted a thing last month on my blog about the only good episode of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. It was an episode called The Cyborg. And my argument for it was it's basically a comic book story, but it's a really smart comic book story. And it is told in such a stylized manner, the audience is never expected to accept it as reality. It is a sci-fi show. You subconsciously know that. And as a result, you just go over, ignore problems that in a realistic film would be popping up at you and you'd have to answer. You just ignore them and you go on, and it actually has a very strong point. It actually, you know, brings out a big question about how we know what is truth and facts. Really good episode. You can find it on YouTube if anybody's interested. It's got Victor Buono in it. He was a San Diego boy. So, really good episode. But anyway, I think the more realistic things look, the harder it is to kind of tell these underlying stories with deeper meaning, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. It made me remember, you know, Lost in Space was never a nighttime show. It was Saturday morning.
Yep.
And so they could get away with all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because it wasn't at night, you know, it wasn't prime time, it wasn't for adults, it was supposed to be for kids, and so they could get away with the green plant that tried to eat the doctor and things like that, which looked like a sock puppet, you know?
Yeah, well, I agree with you on that. I mean, I think one of the problems that Lost in Space had was that they were never the same show from one season to the next. They kept changing their focus all the time.
Oh, yeah, I know. I never understood that. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't notice it, but when I was an adult rewatching it, I was like, what the hell are they doing?
Oh, yeah. The first six episodes are among the finest kid-vid sci-fi that's ever been done.
Mm-hmm.
Really good. And you can tell where the breaking point is, because they did an episode where the planet swings close to the sun and they have to go all the way to the north pole of the planet in order to survive. And Dr. Smith says, I'm going to stay here and just weather it out in the Jupiter 2. And what was supposed to happen was that they come back and they just find a pile of ashes. That's all that's left of Dr. Smith. And he was going to be written out of the series. But by that time, he turned out to be the most popular character on the show. And so they go, well, we got to keep him. So in the end of the episode, they get a radio message from Smith that indicates he survived. And then, you know, he's back in the next episode, and he stayed for the rest of the series.
I didn't remember that. I mean, I didn't remember that episode at all. I don't.
Yeah.
There's some episodes I remember and some episodes I don't. I really actually... My memory, I just liked Robbie the robot.
Oh, yeah. Well, Robbie and the robot from Lost in Space, they actually met twice, you know.
Robbie and
from Forbidden Planet and the robot from Lost in Space.
They actually met?
Yeah, they had two episodes where they meet face-to-face. There's one called War of the Robots where they're fighting each other.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
I I liked the two robots. Those were my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't remember them fighting each other. I remember Robbie being in an episode, but I didn't remember them fighting each other.
Yeah. I worked at Ruby Spears Production. Ruby Spears was Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, and they met on Lost in Space as sound engineers. They were doing the sound editing for the show, and they went from there over to Hanna-Barbera to edit cartoons for Hanna-Barbera, and they couldn't figure out how the shows were supposed to link up, and they went to Joe Barbera and said, let us write one of these because we can't figure out how they're supposed to go together. And Joe Barbera said sure. He let them write an episode, and son of a gun, they were really good at it, so he ended up hiring them as writers and then story editors, and then they created Scooby-Doo and went on to form their own studio.
It is interesting. It's just like when I was a little girl, one of the Saturday afternoon shows was a show called Isis the Goddess, the Egyptian.
Yes.
And I love that show. And
the
thing is that my brother didn't remember it. None of my friends remember it. I was like, it's like almost like it was just, I could visualize it. And it was like, it was almost like, and then I went to a collectible show and I found the VHS, which tells you when the collectible show was, of Isis. And it has her, I still have it on my desk. It has her in the Egyptian outfit as Isis with her falcon on her arm. And I love that show. And it's like, see, it really did happen. It was real.
Yeah. There was a writer on that show, Michael Reeves, who unfortunately just passed away a few months ago. But Michael figured out how to make the show really spectacular without costing him a dime. He figured out Isis could make things not happen. So she would fly in and say, dam, don't burst, bridge, don't collapse. There was any number of things she could make not happen. And they just loved him. They let him write a whole bunch of scripts for him. But, you know, just have her show up and stop bad things from happening.
Gee, I wish there really was a superhero who could do that.
I wish so too, yeah.
But I that was one of my favorite. I didn't even realize until I rewatched the VHS when I got it. I didn't realize that it was a spinoff of Captain America.
Yeah.
I didn't even remember.
Well, not Captain America, Captain Marvel,
which was
called
Shazam,
because there is an incredibly convoluted story behind that, which we won't go into. Basically, DC sued Captain Marvel out of existence. But then they acquired Captain Marvel, and once they acquired Captain Marvel, they wouldn't let him be shown as Captain Marvel. He had to be shown as Shazam. So that's why he's Shazam now in DC.
Okay. Because I didn't remember, but they had one episode with him. It's like a cross episode. And I went, oh, I didn't even remember that it was a spinoff. Because I only remember her. Because I loved her. Because, first of all, I wanted, even at that young age, I wanted to be an archaeologist. And she was an archaeologist, and she was a history teacher. And so I thought, and she was really smart, and she was sweet, and she was, like, one of my favorites. She was a lot like Wonder Woman, but without the whip and the plane and all that.
Yeah. Well, that's because... That's because Filmation Studios couldn't afford a plane.
The invisible plane.
Yeah.
That's one of the cool things about Linda Carter's Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Was the invisible plane was in it.
Yeah. Now, I like the Linda Carter Wonder Woman a lot, particularly the first season when it was set during World War II.
Where it was supposed to be.
Yeah. I felt when they moved it to modern times, they kind of lost, you know, I don't want to say campiness, but they lost
the fun.
The fun, yeah. They lost the fun that made the first season so much fun. And then, you know, they just kept monkeying with it and not improving it. But what, four seasons? That's not bad.
That's not bad. And
yeah.
I really, I thought there were some really clever episodes of,
of
Wonder
yeah.
Woman. And, you know, until from Wonder Woman to Xena, there really wasn't a female superhero.
No.
It that whole thing went so like Isis and Wonder Woman, that was it in the 70s, and then until like was it the late 90s that Xena came?
I think so. Let me take a quick look. Do you remember a show called Cleopatra 2525?
Yeah, that was after Xena, but yeah, I remember
that. Was
that.
After Xena. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, because I remember trying to get into that, and I was watching it, and it was like, well, this is just really kind of like a dumb Bikini Girl movie. And
yeah,
there really wasn't a lot that was appealing about it. I mean,
The thing about it is they wasted really talented actors.
Yeah.
All three of them were spectacular. And if you see them in the stuff they're doing now, you see that they wasted them. I was, like, really disappointed because it was the same company that did Xena. And I, like, why aren't you getting the writers at the level you have for Xena doing this? You know, I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
I think that's why it didn't last very long. But it was a good try. But spectacular actors. And the storylines. Sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, writers. I love you, writers. Yeah.
1995. That was when Xena started.
Okay. It was about the same year as Buffy, I think. Because that's Buffy and Xena were about almost equal. They both came out about the same time. And that was the beginning of girl power for a while. And now it's gone again. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. You get a really successful show, and it's like, why they don't continue doing stuff like that, I don't understand.
Well, I'm a huge fan of the original Dick Van Dyke Show, and they quit after five seasons because they were having a tough time coming up with stories at the end of season five, and they realized it's only going to get tougher. We have pretty much said everything we have to say in this format, in this show, and they made the very wise decision to quit while they were on top. Too many shows. I mean, you know, the classic example of a show jumping the shark literally is Happy Days.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you hit a really high note, and then once you recognize that you were in a state of decline, you should have just graciously bowed out and ended it on a high note, but, you know, petered it out.
Well, you know that Henry Winkler hates that was what they call jumping the shark, because he goes, of all the things that he did athletically on the show, the only thing he was really good at that was something he could do was jet ski and water ski and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, the one time I showed off my only athletic skill, I'm forever hearing about jumping the shark because of it.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't blame him for the idea. That was Gary Marshall's fault. But, I'm a firm believer that you just have to recognize there's a time and place for everything. And sometimes you reach the end and you just say, this is the end.
Yeah,
and you let people leave with a very strong positive memory.
And I really liked Happy Days. It's just that when people started leaving the show, like when Ron Howard left and Ransom Williams left and all these people, it kind of ruined the mix because there was a chemistry, and especially Ron Howard. Ron Howard was essential to Happy Days.
Yeah.
And
I agree on that.
And the relationship between Henry Winkler and Ron Howard as Fonzie and I almost said Opie, and I know that's from Anne Griffith's show.
Richie Cunningham.
Richie. The that was such a special relationship.
Yeah.
It was like brothers. It was like,
yeah,
it's such a good relationship. So when they took him out of the mix, it was, and they were trying to focus it on Henry.
Yeah.
And, Fonzie. It
yeah.
was like, it lost its way.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing against the young actor who came in as the cousin. He was a good actor. But it wasn't the same show. I mean, really, I stopped watching, and I watched the last show because everybody came back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause, oh, and Joni left the show too. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and Chachi, they're all were gone.
Yeah.
And it just
yeah.
lost its zip.
Yeah. Well, it you're right, and they lost the zip because they made the classic error that well, if we have one show that's a hit, if we take some of the people who make it a hit and put them in their own show, then we'll have two hits. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, even the Mary Tyler Moore show, they had the Rhoda spinoff, and they had the
Phyllis.
What was the character that
Phyllis
spinoff. Phyllis didn't do that well. Rhoda did okay, but in both cases, it was detrimental to the main show, and the reason the Mary Tyler Moore show survived was that they wisely did not try to replace the character types. They brought in different character types. They
like
brought
Betty
in
White.
Betty White as just that, she was, that was the finest role I think she ever had. She was hilarious.
Sue Anderson.
And, yeah. Exactly. And they realized, don't try to put in a substitute for someone who's left. Bring in something entirely different. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like my third favorite sitcom of all time. You got Dick Van Dyke, WKRP, and then Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh, Mary Tyler Moore should be higher up.
I will not disparage anyone who thinks it should be higher up. I just have to go with personal preference here.
I loved Mary Tyler. Okay, you can tell I'm a girl, but my favorite shows were first That Girl.
Yes.
Loved That Girl. Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then there's one more, and I'm blanking out on the name. It was another female-oriented show, and I can't remember the name. I can't remember. But those two, for sure, That Girl and Mary Tyler Moore, I love those shows. They were my childhood. They were my teenhood. They were, it's like what Oprah said when she had the reunion with the cast. They were her Saturday night. They were her, you know, they were her everything. And I really, I relate to that because I wanted to be Anne Marie growing up. I wanted to be Mary growing up. I mean, who wouldn't?
The thing that a lot of people fail to understand about That Girl is just how radically different it was at the time.
Uh-huh.
It was the first TV show about a young woman all on her own, working at a career, having her ups and downs, but never being defeated, always continuing to work at her career. And whatever misadventure she might have in a particular episode, the underlying message was, she gets work. She gets cast in dumb things, but she gets cast. She appears in crazy plays, but she's appearing in plays.
Yeah.
And it was telling people, your dreams can come true. You may have to work hard for them, but they can come true.
And the thing
it was
is,
a really good show.
It was one. It's my favorite because she was really a positive role model. She
yes.
She was. She like you said. She kept going, even though
mm-hmm.
things weren't go. Even I mean, let's face it. She lost every waitress job she ever had because if an audition came in,
mm-hmm.
she was out of there.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for her dad, she probably would have starved. Because
mm-hmm.
her dad, when he showed up, he always had a bag of groceries. Did you ever notice that?
Yeah.
And the thing that she wanted most was, see, she was offered a bunch of parts. She was, she had done a pilot, and they loved, the pilot didn't do very well, but her, whatever you call it, her reaction.
Personality?
Yeah. That was like, they apparently Breck Kerr loved her and wanted her to be in their next show. And so they gave her a bunch of scripts, but it was always the daughter, the mother, the wife.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't want to do that. And she talked to the head of the studio, who she said luckily was a really nice man. And she goes, did you ever hear, I forgot the name of the book, but it's by Betty Friedan. Do you remember?
The Feminine Mystique?
Feminine Mystique. Did you ever hear The Feminine Mystique? It's about how women are trying to create a life. It's not, it's for, that you can have wonderful men in your life, but you have your own focus and stuff, and you still have relations
yeah.
and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, that's what I want. That's what I want. And she goes, I'll tell you what. And this is the funniest part. In the interview, she even giggled when she told it. She told him that she could get Persky and, oh, what was the partner?
I know who you're talking about, but I can't remember the name right now. Yeah.
And
it was a writing team, yeah.
They worked for her dad doing
yeah.
the Danny Thomas show, Make Room for Daddy.
Yeah.
And she says, I can get them. She goes, and she said in the interview, she goes, I didn't really know if they would do it. She said, I just knew they were the hottest writing team. And she goes, and I knew them because we did charades once a week. So that's how she knew them. And it turns out that the reason I remember Persky, because I remember what he said, he was sick of doing male-oriented shows. He wanted to do a show focused on a woman, and she just timed it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his partner both said, yeah, we want to do something different. We're sick of doing shows that are centered on guys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how That Girl came about, was because
mm-hmm.
of what, and she said she didn't want her to get married, and she didn't even want her to get engaged. She goes, she wanted them to be boyfriend and girlfriend, but she didn't want the marriage part because she felt it was a cop out.
Mm-hmm.
That here she is, you know, wanting to be Miss Independence and all this stuff, and then at the end they're going to marry her off like a Jane Austen novel. She just
yeah.
didn't feel it was right. So
yeah.
that's why they didn't. They had that weird thing where the fantasy wedding thing, but but she never really got married. They were just. In fact, the last show she took Donald to a women's liberation meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bet. He lost the bet.
Yeah.
He had to go to the women's liberation meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But that was such an influence on me. I mean,
mm-hmm.
here I am. I think when the show was 65 or 66. So I think I started watching it in rerun at 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the live shows, the nighttime shows, I watched them the last year, 2 years or something
yeah.
like that. And
yeah.
I mean, it was I was a feminist. I became
yeah.
a feminist because of That Girl.
That Girl was it was a tremendous show. I remember it when it came on, and it was, as I recall, it was initially pitched to audiences as the ditzy actress thing, and they were pitching it as one kind of thing, and I think it caught people by surprise in a good way. They realized, well, this is actually a show that's got a lot of heart to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is about something. This
mm-hmm.
is not just how many embarrassing situations can we put, you know, the star in. This is actually about somebody's quest for their own identity, quest for their own career, shaping their own future. And yeah, it is a quixotic quest in that any showbiz career, even the successful ones, is a long shot. The successful ones are just the ones where the long shot pays off. But it accurately reflected that. It accurately reflected all the things that you had to do just to work your way up the food chain.
You had to be a chicken.
Yeah. And
that was an episode.
Oh, I remember the one where she ends up being the mop on the kids show.
Oh, yeah. That was, I think that was the pilot, Buzz.
It was?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the one where her parents were breaking up because she had moved out and her father wanted her mother to move in to spy on her. And she came and she goes, oh, so you're here to spy on me? She goes, no, I left him because he wanted me to spy on you, but I have nowhere else to go, so I'm coming to stay here.
No, that's what made that show so good. I mean, the family dynamics were believable. They were realistic. The scale, this is another thing. I find too many shows nowadays, the scale is too large. It's like, it's always a world-threatening crisis. It's always, you know, an alien invasion. It's always a magician. You know, they did stories that were on a very human scale. Even if you weren't in showbiz, you could understand the struggle she was going through just trying to make her way in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's something I think we're missing in a lot of entertainment today. Everything has to be so big and so over the top. Just give us some stuff that we find interesting. Give us something that's
and fun.
Got some heart to it.
And fun. That's what's missing in sitcoms today. There's no heart and no fun.
I had a friend who used to describe that as they sprayed it with fun away.
I remember the third show. You're gonna laugh at me though. Bewitched.
Ah, yes, Bewitched. That was an interesting one.
I loved the magic. I loved Samantha, and I loved Darren and Dora and Maurice and Uncle Arthur.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth playing the other part of Serena.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was such a fun show.
It was a silly sitcom, but the right kind of silly. It acknowledged its silliness. It's the kind of show that says at the very beginning, okay, all bets are off. Anything can happen. Just sit back and enjoy it. And once you're given permission to do that, then you can embrace it. Then you go, okay, this is crazy. This is nuts, but fine. I'm laughing. That's all that it has to do. Make me laugh.
And they had such great actors.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and you know, I think I got my appreciation of Shakespeare from Maurice Evans as Maurice, because was there an episode that he didn't break into Shakespeare? I grew up listening to Shakespeare because I wanted to be Bewitched. That's why it wasn't like a shock to my system when, like some of the other kids, even though they were my age. When we went to English class and they started having us read from Shakespeare, oh yeah, Maurice talked to this one.
I'm gonna break away for a moment here, but it's something I've noticed in a lot of people. They ask me, where do you get your ideas? And I say, I'm bombarded all day long. And don't you pick up on these things? That things just come flying at you from every direction. And we'll be talking about history, or we'll be talking about Shakespeare, or we'll be talking about movies or something. And I'll go, well, yeah, that was based on this or that. And say, how do you know this? And I'm going, how do you not know it?
Exactly.
The information is out there like a fire hose, and you're not getting wet.
You're not getting wet. That's good. I like that analogy. But that's true. It's interesting because I'm part of a mystery reading group online, and it's Golden Age Mysteries, and it's really fun because I'm learning authors I'd never heard of, so I'm reading all these, really the only Golden Age authors that I knew were Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Ellery Queen, the guy who wrote Thin Man, Dashiell Hammett, and that's
Dashiell
it.
Hammett, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really, Sam Spade, I forgot.
Yeah.
Whoever wrote Sam Spade. Those were the ones I knew. That's it.
Yeah.
And I'm discovering this entire world of writers that I'd never heard of before. But the weird thing is, Buzz, is that when you're talking about it, you end up talking about the adaptions, and then when you start talking about the adaptions, you talk about other movies, and it's like the books and movies, they mix together, and the inspiration that's there is monumental. But how can you not see it? But people don't, you know? And I think it's the same today. I think it's the same. I think that, you know, because they're in their own little box, people don't look beyond the box.
Yep. No, that's so true. I mean, I follow a number of comics pages on Facebook, and the ones I don't follow are the superhero oriented ones, because generally the people in the superhero oriented ones, they're barely aware that there were comics other than superheroes.
Oh yeah, I'm the Archies. I'm a big Archie fan.
Archies? Well, you know, Archies, you had Walt Disney comics.
Yeah, I had those too.
You had Gold Key that had all of these different kinds of stories. They would have detective stories, westerns, movie adaptations.
Looney Tunes.
You had Looney Tunes. Well, you had romance comics. You had true crime comics.
And there was war comics. Like, they would have, like, World War II.
Yeah, they had just this enormous variety of material out there, and yet today, I'd say 90% of the people who identify as comics fans, the only thing they know about are superhero comics, and in most cases, they don't know about anything that came before the Marvel age, and in a lot of cases, they're not aware of anything that came before the year 2000.
That's the thing that drives me crazy about movies, that people don't know anything that happened before, forget 2000, before 1990s. I mean, 1990s seems to be like the break-off time. It's the weirdest thing. And they won't watch black and white movies. I'm like, are you kidding me? Some of the best movies ever made are black and white. The Day the Earth Stood Still. Bringing a Baby, now Voyager. There's so many great movies in black and white. Casablanca.
I'm going to tell you something, and this might irritate you, but I apologize in advance if it does. On YouTube, there are a number of people who have been taking old silent films, colorizing them, and then adding music, sound effects, and in the case of Laurel and Hardy, they've been lifting dialogue from the sound Laurel and Hardy films to kind of put in to you know, just help move the story along. If it gets people to watch what they wouldn't watch before, I'm in favor of it. I mean, if it gets somebody who would never look at Laurel and Hardy, never look at Harold Lloyd or Buster Keaton, if it'll get them to just take a look at what the geniuses did back then, great, that's wonderful. I go, okay, fine, I'll accept that. But yeah, you're right. They were filmed for specific venues, specific conditions. They would go in and they knew in advance that they were going to be black and white, and they lit them and they designed them for black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the Addams Family TV show, okay? If you've ever seen color photos of the set was pink. And the reason it was pink was that pink under the studio lights provided the right contrast to the predominantly black and white costumes that the actors were wearing.
Mm-hmm.
And
I,
so it's really weird to see them against this, you know, vivid pink background, but it was shot deliberately that way.
I remember my shock. I grew up watching the Munsters, and when they made the movie, I was about 9 or 10, and the shock of the way that they made up Herman, the color green, it kind of threw me because it wasn't what I expected. I was expecting,
yeah,
like, color, the way that, Frankenstein monster was made in color movies.
Yeah.
He was made green. It was the weirdest thing. I mean, I still don't understand why they decided to make him green.
I'll tell you why. The makeup that Karloff wore in the first three Frankenstein movies had a green tint to it because under the lighting conditions that they were using, it made it appear a very ghastly, pale look. If they had made his face up with, you know, light makeup, white, you know, grease paint, it would have washed him out. But the green provided just enough contrast to, you could look at him and go, yeah, that looks like a dead guy walking right there. For Son of Frankenstein, there is actually a short test reel. In fact, I'll take that back. It's not even the test reel. It's 8mm footage that somebody shot when they were doing the color test of Karloff wearing the green makeup. And so the Frankenstein monster being green, in reality, that was the way he was made up in the black and white movies. When they got around to doing him for television, they followed through. They used the green tint to make him look, give him that power, you know, on black and white TV. And then when they make a color movie, well, they did too much. They went in the opposite direction.
Oh, but it was such a weird color green on the monsters. I mean, it was like a blue green. It was just bizarre.
Yeah. Well,
I was like, I enjoyed it. I mean, it was still a good show, but it was funny. It was, you know, same actors. It was really, even though Yvonne Craig's character was supposed to be a vampire, they gave her a yellow tinge, but it was a different color than the grandfather, who was also a vampire.
Yeah.
So it was stuff like that. The color palette, and this is it's still a memory from when I was, what they did for it to make the people want to see it at home was they gave a copy of it to schools. And so just before, I think it was Easter vacation, they gave it to our school, and we watched it in the gym, all the kids, it was like an assembly. And that's the first time I ever saw it, was on a big screen. Because the next time it was shown was on television. But the thing was, I came home and I told my parents. They knew you had to get a permission slip because you were staying after school.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew, and they said, "Well, did you enjoy it?" I go, "Yeah, but it was weird." And Dad goes, "What do you mean it was weird?" I go, "Herman was like blue green. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen." And I can't remember her name. Lily. Lily was like yellow, and Grandpa was grayish, and it was and Eddie was like brown. It was weird.
That was because they were trying to translate the black, the makeup for black and color. Have you ever seen the Frederick March version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was young. I haven't seen it since, though.
Yeah. They did a remarkable trick in it that can only be done in black and white, but it just works incredibly well. And what they did was they put blue makeup on Frederick March's face for Mr. Hyde. So they put the makeup on, but then they light him with a blue light. And as they're filming the scene, they dim the blue light and they slide a gradiated red filter in front of the camera, which makes the blue makeup stand out in stark contrast. With the blue light, it gets washed out. But when the light is dimmed and the red filter comes in, it just starts to come out. And you're watching Frederick March moving around. He's not doing the trick like with the Wolfman, where the Wolfman falls down and he remains motionless while he goes through a series of dissolves. Frederick March is like writhing around and grasping his throat, but he's changing right in front of your eyes. And you could only do that in black and white. You know, now they would use CGI, but yeah. Back then it made an impact. I mean, you were looking at something and going, how in the world did they do this?
They were geniuses, especially with lighting. It's amazing what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah.
We've come to the part where we're going to talk about your new book. So why don't you tell us about it and where we can get it and all that good stuff.
Okay, well, I'll start off by explaining, you know, we were just talking about where ideas come from, how writers see themselves as bombarded with ideas all day long. Several years ago, I was I forget what it was, but I had stumbled across a news story about something that had happened in Brattleboro, Vermont in the summer of 2000. And you actually have to go back to the mid-70s for the start of this story. In the mid-70s, there was a hippie commune right outside Brattleboro. A hippie commune, there was, you know, a lot of skinny dipping in the creek. There was a lot of topless farming. There were all kinds of shenanigans going on in the woods. And the people of Brattleboro, a lot of them didn't like this. But Vermont is one of the most fiercely independent and contrarian states that we have. And while half the people didn't like it, the other half of the people in town were, hey, it's their property, they can do whatever they want on it. And there was a big fight that went on in the community over this. Now, the way New England towns are organized government-wise is that once a year, typically in March, they have a town meeting where the entire town gets together, debates what needs to be done over the next year, fixes a budget for it, figures out how they'll raise the budget, votes on it, and then once it's approved, they hand it over to a town manager to run the town for a year. And then the next year they come back and do it all over again. The thing is, if they make a mistake, if they don't budget enough, if they pass a law that has a flaw in it, they can't do anything about it until the next town meeting. So in 75, roughly, but thereabouts, they have a town meeting and they come up with this compromise that everything within the hippie commune, and the hippie commune was on a old farm, and they defined the boundaries as these three roads and a creek that bordered it. Everything within the hippie commune was a clothing optional area. The moment you crossed the road, you had to put your clothes on. So this was the compromise that everybody agreed to live with. The hippies could do whatever they want on their commune, but you know, if you come into town, be fully dressed. So after a few years, the commune went out of business. Most of the people left. A few of them stayed at Brattleboro, became citizens. The farm passed from hand to hand after that and eventually ended up with a real estate developer who subdivided it and turned it into shopping centers and housing. And Brattleboro moved into this area, basically. They forgot the clothing optional law was still on the books. in the year 2000, somebody discovered the clothing optional law was still there and took advantage of it. And of course, Brattleboro had a hissy fit about it, but there wasn't anything they could do about it, because until there's a town meeting, you've got to obey the law. And the law clearly said it was a clothing optional zone. Now, in real life, there were only about, from my research, there were only about like 12 to 16 people who ever participated in this. But for my story, which is called Cheeky, I stretch it so that, you know, all the high schoolers in this town, you know, over the course of the summer participate at one time or another. And it's basically a story that traces how an idea or a fad or whatever you want to call it goes from unthinkable to outrageous to edgy to chic to fashionable to mainstream to passé, only it does so over the course of a single summer. And it is being serialized right now on Kindle Vella. And just about every day you'll get a brand new chapter, because it follows the summer day by day as the story progresses. The only every now and then I have to because the chapters are short, I have to put two or three days together. But you'll find a brand new chapter almost every day, and the story is complete. It will run through until early September. And then in October, we will have a Kindle ebook, and we will have a POD book available through Amazon.
Cool. That sounds like really cool. It's like an old serial like they used to do with magazines.
Yes, yes. In fact, one of the things that's appealing about Vella is when you look at a lot of the old classic, what we call classic literature now, like Dickens, to be, you know, the biggest example, most of his stuff was serialized. Most of it appeared over, several months in various magazines. So this is the same thing. And the nice thing about Kindle Vella is the first three chapters are always free. And then after that, it kind of works like Wattpad. If you sign up, you get tokens. And I believe they give you 200 free tokens if you sign up, and then you have to buy more, but, you know, you'll get 200 free as a bonus. And then you pay for each new chapter using the tokens. And depending upon how many words are in the chapter, that's how many tokens it costs. If it's like 600 words, you pay 6 tokens. If it's 2,000 words, you pay 20 tokens, things like that. But you get to read the story bit by bit and decide if you like it enough to want to commit to it all the way. Because, I mean, we've all been in the situation where we've seen a book and we buy it because the cover looks interesting and the blur makes it sound interesting. And then we're about like a quarter of the way into it and it's like, this really isn't doing anything for me. Well, the nice thing about Kindle Vella is you are not committed to finishing the story. If you get to a certain point and you're not connecting with it, you can go read something else, you know. But if you do connect with it, then you've got a chapter on a regular basis. And it's bite-sized so that you can read it on your phone in just a few minutes' time. So if you're like, if you're waiting for something, if you're, you know, got some downtime, you can just whip your phone out, read a chapter, and then, wait for the next one to come along.
It sounds really interesting. I've actually not read anything on there. So I'd probably try yours out.
Okay. I'm doing this in the hopes of getting people aware of it. Right now, I'm not worried about making money. I am worried more about finding readers, and I really want to encourage people to give it a try. Try the first three chapters for free. You see if you like it, and if you do, sign up and keep reading.
It sounds good. Is it going to be published traditionally too, after the serial's done?
It'll be published through Amazon, so it'll be like, I think they call it Kindle Direct Publishing now. I may be wrong on that, but yes, you will be able to go on Amazon and order it as either a ebook or as a trade paperback.
Okay. And when has it already started, or I mean, the serial?
Oh, it's already started. Yeah, it's already started. We're about, I think maybe. Oh wow, we're at least a dozen chapters into it by now, I think. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it's complete. So there are some people who are a little anxious about signing on to Kindle Vella because they're worried. Well, if I start something, what happens if the writer, you know, punks out and doesn't finish it? I will never put anything on Kindle Vella until it is complete, and then the whole thing goes up. It's just scheduled to come out day by day. So if you sign on and you like it, you will get all the way to the end. There is a conclusion, and you'll be able to follow the story all the way through.
That's cool. And is it like going to have a sequel, or it depends how this sounds?
I'll be honest with you. I am right now in kind of a one and done phase in my life, and by that I mean I'm tired of people who write stories that don't have conclusions, that they, you know, they leave you with a cliffhanger so you'll come back for the next book. I mean, I enjoy certain types of you know, serialized fiction. I mean, not serialized, but series fiction. You know, when I was a kid, I read Doc Savage, for instance. But personally, I'd rather write stories that reach a conclusion, and when they're done, they're done. But I am writing new stories all the time. Come September, I will be starting a new serial on Kindle Vella. It'll be called Uncle Lard, which is set in the early days of the television industry in 1946. And I have more stories in line after that. And so there'll be quite a few things that I've done that'll be coming up over the next couple of years.
That's cool. We've come to the end. So for people who didn't hear your first interview with me, would you give your website and any social media you have?
Sure. My blog is buzzdixon.com. That's all one word, BUZZDIXON. I am on Facebook. You can find me pretty easy. I'm on Instagram as Buzz Dixon Writer, and I am on Post Social as Buzz Dixon Writer.
Great. And do you have any events or anything coming up, like book fairs or conventions or anything like that?
Not on the horizon very soon. I mean, I have promise to attend a convention in early fall, but I have to wait until they actually tell me what the date is. So I'll let people know then.
All right, that's fair. I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to come chat with me so we could catch up.
I was delighted to do this, Sherry. Thank you very much for having me on. Let me tell people about Cheeky.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to read that. It sounds like fun. Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.